What I like about it, really what it does it for me is it's the perseverance aspect. It's the never give up, the keep moving forward, that okay, you captured again. It's the fact that you can be, you know, essentially on your knees and being beat down to the bottom of everything, but yet you still fight through it and survive and ultimately escape and get away.
Welcome to My Movie Story. I'm your host, Brian McAleer. This is the podcast where we dive into the movies that have shaped us. Each episode, we sit down with a special guest to discuss their all-time favorite film, the movie that changed their life, and the one film they think everyone needs to see. Get ready as we journey through the cinematic worlds that make us who we are. This is My Movie Story. My guest for this episode is Bob Thompson. Bob is from Virginia in the US, and he's a motivational speaker, a seasoned life coach, and a real estate expert. But he's more than that too. He's all about helping others overcome obstacles, bounce back, and create real change in their lives. After overcoming two heart attacks, he emerged stronger than ever. And he likes to teach his life lessons to others, which involve persistence and taking charge of one's own life. Now, here's our interview with Bob. Well, hi, Bob. Welcome to My Movie Story. It's good to have you. How are you today?
I am good. Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to the podcast. I've been listening and watching some of your other ones, so I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, excited to have you. And yeah, thank you for being a watcher and a listener. It's always good to meet a fan, so to speak. And yeah, and you're joining us all the way from the United States. And you live in the state of Virginia. You were telling me a bit about that before. And yeah, so tell us a little bit about yourself, Bob. You know, where are you from, and what do you do with yourself?
All right. I am almost 52. I live in Chesapeake, Virginia, which essentially is right by Norfolk, Virginia. Obviously, I'm in the Norfolk area, Williamsburg. So a lot of military, a lot of history, that type of stuff. I am a real estate agent by trade. I am also a motivational speaker. I've done some speaking. I've got a book coming out soon. And I enjoy movies. I've actually had the pleasure of being in a couple of movies. Right. That have been on Amazon and Tubi, nothing major, very small parts, but it's fun to do. I've got a buddy of mine that does them. Matter of fact, we recently just had the first ever Virginia Black Film Festival, and I was a part of that and got to help Brian with that project and all of that good stuff. So it was a lot of fun. Got to meet some really cool people, watch some good films, and always a good time.
Fantastic. Yeah. So sounds like, yeah, there's a lot of things there that you're doing and that you're involved in, which is really cool. So just tell us briefly a bit about Virginia, because I know there's a Virginia and there's a West Virginia. And you know, my American geography it's okay, but I don't know much about those states. So like, yeah, tell us a little bit about the background, and have you lived there all your life ever, pretty much?
I've lived in Virginia all my life. Virginia is essentially one of the, if not the oldest state, you know, in the United States.
Yeah.
You figure we had Jamestown, which was the original, you know, one of the very original first colonies to land and set up everything there. Obviously, we were part of the South during the Civil War and all of that. Over the years, Virginia's changed quite a lot to where we're way more, like I said, we talked earlier, it's kind of a blend to where it's very cosmopolitan in certain spots and it's very rural in other areas. And again, since we've been here for forever, there's a ton of history. I mean, again, you've got everything that went on. Seems like most of what went on in the Revolutionary War either happened in Virginia or Massachusetts, one of the two.
Yep.
And same thing with the Civil War, where 90% of what went on in the Civil War seemed to be, you know, right here in Virginia. Wow. And then obviously, if it was West Virginia, kind of split off and did their own thing and went to the, I guess we'll call it the northern side of things.
Yep.
After Civil War and all of that. So
right.
Just a lot of history that, and we, like I said, we've been around it forever.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Well, when I've been to the States, I've done New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and Boston. So I did a lot of the historical stuff there, like the Liberty Bell, the Freedom Trail, all that stuff. But yeah, I'm really interested in the Civil War history. I don't know a lot about it. So next time I'm in the States, I'll have to drop by and maybe you can give me a tour or something.
There's plenty of it between the Revolutionary War and Civil War. We've got it. They've got it mapped out pretty well. And between Jamestown and Williamsburg, that's all Revolutionary War. And then they've got all of the all of the Civil War stuff, Fort Monroe and Hampton, stuff like that. So we've got a little bit of everything.
Fantastic. Yeah, lots to do, it sounds like. Yeah. And you're a motivational speaker now as well. So could you tell us a little bit about some of the subjects you talk to, some of the audiences you might talk to?
Well, that started originally. I had two heart attacks and a quadruple bypass in 2018.
Jeez.
So I lost everything. And then as I recovered, I really wanted to kind of give back for the real estate end of things. And it kind of went from mentoring new agents and young agents to just speaking and coaching in general, using some of the tools and methods that I use to get myself back where I needed to be, which is essentially, I talk a lot about, self-checks and persistent progress and things of that nature. So I've spoken to college audiences about honesty in business, and I've got some other speeches planned. And then a lot of what I do is more of a Les Brown style than a Tony Robbins style, to where it's okay, you've got to, you make your own progress every day. And sometimes it can be as simple as, okay, I got up and I did one of the four things that I needed to get done because I didn't feel good or whatever. So I focus more on that and not so much on some of the time management gurus and the, okay, you got to get up at 3 a.m. and do an ice bath and all this other stuff. I don't follow that. And I'm, even with my real estate, I'm known for just being kind of bluntly honest and kind of a misfit. I do my things my own way and it works for me. And I kind of feel like everybody needs to do it, that needs to, whatever they're doing, make it your own and be done with it. So
Yeah,
that's pretty much how I kind
that's
of go with
awesome.
things.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with you there, Bob. I think, and as time's gone by, I've begun to realize that as well. And I was the same when I was young and starting out on my, personal development journey. I'm like, I've got to be like Tony Robbins. This guy leaps out of bed at 6 a.m. and he's, he's full of energy all the time. And I tried to be that, and it's like, that's not me. I've just got, you've got to find your own style, and what works for you. So yeah, couldn't agree more. And I think, yeah, that's what everybody needs, is you can definitely take inspiration from some of those gurus, and they've got some interesting ideas. But yeah, I think I like your approach. It's like, find your own way, make it work for you. It doesn't have to be like everyone else, it can just be your own thing. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
And
And everybody's not for everybody. Again, I'm a Les
exactly.
Brown guy.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to Les Brown. Even to this day, I'll go, if I'm, having a day, I'll go back and listen to Les Brown. I was never a Tony Robbins guy. Nothing against Tony Robbins. Clearly, he has his people and his followers. And that's the thing. We all find what works for us, just like whether it's the same way with movies. We all like certain types of movies that maybe
That's right.
our significant other or our friends don't like.
And you mentioned you're writing a book, or you've got a book coming out as well. Can you tell us a
We've
bit about
got a
that?
book and a course coming out, shameless plug, at whatbobthinks.com. It's called Want More, Take More. It's a book, it's a video course. I kind of did a hybrid of things because I feel like I come across a little bit better on a video course than I do on the written word, because I'm kind of matter of fact and to the point. So I just felt like there's a couple of different ways to do it. And then that way you can actually, since it's a video course, you can technically, you can sit back and just listen to the audio and be done with it. And I like it. It's weird. That's coming out. I'm excited about it. And I've got some other things coming up. But I, at this point, honestly, after almost dying repeatedly, I'm just happy to be alive. And there's only a few people whose opinion I care about, so I don't really worry about the rest of it.
Fantastic. And it's a great way to take a massive experience like that and turn it into a positive, and to help other people as well. So great, that's really noble. And yeah, it's great to have you here on the podcast, and I've been looking forward to our chat. And we discussed your films a while back. I've had a chance to watch them and pick them apart a little bit, and I'm really keen to hear your thoughts on these films and the stories behind them. We're in the mid-20s of our episodes now in season two, so I'm assuming most people watching or listening to this know how the show works. But just in case you don't, if it's your first time listening or watching, welcome. And My Movie Story is all about meeting everyday people here, like Bob and all the other guests that we've had, and three films that they will talk about. So their all-time favorite film, or one of their all-time favorites, because we've all got more than one favorite. A film that they think everybody should see in their lifetime, and then a film that changed that person's perspective or changed their life. So those are the categories, and every episode is different, every person is different, and their film selections are always, really personal. So, oh, and there's the cat. Hello, cat. Cats never have a problem in jumping in front of a camera, do they? They're like, who are you
No,
talking to? Who are
they
you talking
don't.
to? Yeah. Fantastic. Well, let's get into it, shall we, Bob? So we've got your first film we're going to talk about, which is the film that you think everyone should see. And first time watching it for me, I was aware of this film and I had to sort of track down a copy, and I found a copy. And yeah, this is an action film from the 80s. And you're going to tell us all about it. So what is this film and why should everybody see it?
Okay, so Red Dawn obviously is the, I believe came out 84, 85, somewhere in there. It's actually one of the things it's known for. It's one of the first PG-13 movies, believe it or not.
So why should we be different?
Because we live here.
For a bunch of kids, huh?
Mama'd be real proud.
Wolverines!
It, obviously, it has Patrick Swayze in it. It's kind of at his, I don't, it's pre-Ghost, so it's right before he kind of takes over and becomes the man. It's essentially Midwestern teens fight the communist bad guys. They come to America. It's a classic. What makes it fit is it's a classic 80s shoot 'em up movie that you couldn't make now, and it's full of guns and hunting and all of this other stuff that it's the at the time it's still the Cold War, to where the communists are the Russians are the bad guys, and they're the evil people in the world. So it only comes from that perspective. That's why I like it. It's a slice of my childhood. You can, Red Dawn is right there with, I mean, let's be honest, it's a half a dozen other those kind of America against the world sort of movies, whether it's Rambo or Predator. It's that big budget, classic action, the hero sort of movie, even though in this one they don't necessarily win, but they still done it. It's a classic. It's been remade, and the remake was garbage. But again, it's just a classic. Everybody from the 80s, you grew up watching that film. You just did. You rented it on video afterwards, or you saw it in the theaters, and it ranks right up there with multiple showings like Return of the Jedi, Star Wars, or anything like that. I mean, it's been watched that many times.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you mentioned it's got Patrick Swayze in and a couple other stars of the 80s, including Charlie
Oh, good
Sheen.
Lord. Yeah. C. Thomas Howe. There's a couple of female actresses that are fairly, that are well known for the time period. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Oh, Jennifer Grey, who would go on to be in
Gray,
Dirty Dancing with
Powers
Patrick
Booth.
Swayze.
Yeah. So again, this is pre-Dirty Dancing, so it's kind of like boom, right around the corner, there we are.
Yeah, there you go. And it really, it wastes no time. This movie gets right into it. Like the kids are literally in school, the teacher's going on about something, and then all of a sudden you see these soldiers just parachuting from the sky, in dozens and dozens of them, and they just open fire, and it's like a full-on attack. So, obviously, it's about a foreign enemy invading America, but it's actually about two countries that work together, sort of, and plot this huge invasion. So, can you tell us a little bit about that part of the story, like who are the countries, how do they get into America, and what's their deal?
Essentially,
Like, yeah.
it's Russia and Cuba, and they kind of, again, they come in and drop the parachutes and everything else, and figure, okay, the best way to take over is to hit here and wipe out Middle America. It's a great way to start the film. Apparently, the director was really kind of one of those, I hate to say it, but I'm going to say it anyway, kind of a generic classic American guy. Like, he was really into guns. He made several movies that were kind of that same sort of style. So he kind of put his own little stamp on it, to where, you don't speak softly, you speak loud, and you carry the biggest stick you can possibly find, and you're banging and shooting on everybody. So there was the subplot of where the Cuban fighters are there. They don't necessarily want to be there, but obviously Russia's leading the charge, and they got to do what they've got to do. There's the aspect of the kids kind of grow up very quickly, and there's some scenes in there where, you know, C. Thomas Howe, of course, learns to, I guess he essentially goes off the deep end because he gets into the killing way more than he thought than he should have along the way. So yeah. It's just, it's a big budget American film in every aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really interesting setup because, you know, made in the 80s and set in the 80s, you know, where these action films were really starting to come out of the woodwork. And I guess it took the, you know, the Cold War in Russia and the tensions there between America and the US and Russia. And then obviously the threat from Cuba in the 50s, I believe, or 60s it was, with like the Cuban Missile 60s, Crisis yeah. and stuff. So it was kind of like a mishmash of those two sort of threats rolled into one. So I guess when that came out, how old would you have been? You're about 10 years older than me.
So that was 84, I believe, yeah. when it came out. That would have put me 12.
About 12, right. So did you see it when yeah. it first came out? Were you allowed to go and see
it? I did not see it in theaters. I saw it on probably Cinemax or HBO or one of the movie right. channels or on video when it came
yep.
out
yep.
Afterwards.
Yep.
We went to the movies enough, but not certainly not every single time. And that would have been, being a PG-13 movie, my mother probably would not have let me go to the theater to see it. My mother was pretty hardcore when it came to
yeah.
you know, sex and violence and all the stuff, you sure. know,
yeah.
stuff. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't allowed to watch rated R movies until I was essentially literally 17. My mother was yeah. pretty hardcore on that type of stuff.
Yeah.
So it would have been yeah. on video after.
That's right. I remember being a kid and all I wanted to do was watch all these big action movies. And I was about 9 or 10 years old when Terminator 2 came out in the cinema. And I wanted to go and see it at the movies because it was the biggest movie in the world at that time. And mum was like, no, you're not watching it. So I didn't get to see it at the cinema. And then it came out at the video store. And I was at the video store all the time as a kid. And I would see it on the shelf. I'm like, can we get it? Can we get it? And I'd be there with mum and or dad. And they're like, no, no, you can't watch it. And then one night, my mum was taking my sisters out somewhere. Dad had come home from work. And he waited till mum was gone. And he went into his jacket and pulled out Terminator 2 on video. I'm like, yes.
Nice.
And he's like,
that's a total bad right there.
Yeah, I was only 9 or 10. He says, you can watch it, but I have to watch it with you, and if it gets too violent, then we'll turn it off. And there was a couple of scenes there where I went like, ooh, you know, that were quite squeamish, and my dad was ready to leap up. He's like, should I turn it off? I'm like, no, I'm watching it. And then the next day I went back to school and was telling all my friends. I was bragging, I've watched Terminator 2, and they're all like, you're allowed to watch Terminator 2? I'm like, yeah. It's like my dad would be there and he'd fast forward through any graphic scenes, or, you know, if there was like a sex scene in a movie, he'd stand there in front of the TV with his arms like this when he couldn't fast forward it. So I was allowed to watch this stuff, but I had to be supervised. So yeah. Funny nice. Story.
That's and, a classic dad.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I'd do the same with my daughters, I guess, but they don't want to watch that kind of stuff yet. So, And in Red Dawn, because it starts off with, you know, the soldiers just invade this small American town. The kids are at school. They basically run out the door. You know, a bunch of them get into a pickup truck driven by Patrick Swayze. They stop off at a gas station, grab some supplies, and basically head into the wilderness, right? And then they hang out for a while. They lay low, and then they finally kind of decide, you know, they're going to fight. They're going to fight back. So yeah, can you talk a little bit about, I guess, those characters, what they go through, how they change from, you know, just being kids in school, and sort of where they end up at the end of the film? Like, can you talk a little bit about that, well, you know, transformation?
I think it's important. I mean, that's one of the good things. And I personally am not a hunter, but I have friends of mine that are hunters. And I think in the context of the film and the movie, it makes sense that they know how to do those type of things and they can handle it. So there's that aspect of it. And I think it's just the fact that, okay, you kind of went from worrying about high school prom and getting to third base with Susie, and the next thing you know, you're literally shooting people
yeah.
and you're quite not of age. A lot of those kids within the movie are 12, 13, or 14. And of course, again, in the 80s, you've got to remember that's a time period where you could, and granted, you know how Americans are with our guns, but at the time, you literally could bring your hunting weapon to school. You could put it in your hunting, leave it in your vehicle, and then when you left school for the day, then you would take it and you could go finish hunting for the rest of the day. And you could do that in Virginia. I remember being in high school, and I graduated in 90, to where it was nothing at all to see rifle racks, and guys would either go hunt first thing in the morning during deer season, and then when they got done, they would go back out, because again, you've got a limited window for the deer hunting, so you want to get in as much as you can.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, I personally was not, I'm not a hunter, only I don't have an issue with it. I've got friends of mine that love it, and I'll enjoy the heck out of the deer meat and all of that, but you're not getting me up at 4 a.m. to go shoot anything.
You got to be pretty committed.
Yeah, you got to be committed, and it's something that you enjoy, and I think it's still important to have people to do that and have the respect for, because it's not an easy thing to do. Not everybody can shoot straight, or so it's like anything. You got to have respect for everybody's hobbies, and you can. Some people will say, okay, well, if you shoot the deer, you're killing defenseless animals. Well, they've, unfortunately, within the states, they've discovered that if you don't cull the herd from time to time, you end up with too many animals of one type or another. It's the same way with coyotes and wolves and stuff like that. If you don't thin those herds, and they're going to take over and destroy something else, something's got to give. So it's just, it just marks that kind of beginning of that 84, 85, 86 time period where everything coming out in America was big budget. You start to see the big budget action movie. Then it kind of switches to the individual loner action hero with your Die Hards and your Schwarzenegger coming through, Stallone coming out with all of his stuff. So it really kind of marks a transition to where everything just got bigger and louder over the course of probably 4 or 5 years. And you couldn't make let's be honest, through that time period, if you made an art film, 4 people were going to see it. It just, nobody was watching that. It was either really broad-based comedy or it was really big budget action. And there was no room for any sort of thought-provoking film that would really have any effect.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. It was such a fascinating time, the 80s. And for you, you grew up as a kid and a teen in the 80s. So, you know, I'm quite jealous of that, actually. Because, you know, I think that was probably the best decade to be a kid in.
I am a child of the 80s. That is me to a T. Atari and all of this and everything that came with it, I own it and embrace it. And if I had the money and the space and the time, I would still have all of my original Star Wars and all of my stuff and every other thing. I like to look at it online, but I'm not going out there and dropping $300 for stuff that was given to me for Christmas, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Like everything from the 80s is like a collectible these days. And And just with Red Dawn, I had to mention that I had to draw a comparison to this film to an Australian book, which has also been turned into a movie called Tomorrow When the War Began. And it's by an Australian author called John Marsden. And every Australian who's watching this knows that book and movie. We all probably read it in high school English. And it's about these 7 kids who live in this small country town, and they decide to go camping for a weekend. And when they come back to town, it's empty, and they realize that this army has invaded their town. So they kind of become soldiers and have to survive. And it got made into a movie, and it's fantastic. So as I was watching Red Dawn, I was thinking, oh, maybe the author kind of drew some inspiration from this. That's kind of the reverse in Red Dawn, where they're in town when the invasion happens and they escape and come back. So they know what's going on. But in Tomorrow When the War Began, they're just kids who've gone camping. They come back and their parents are missing. The houses are empty. The streets are empty. Everyone's been rounded up by this army. And in Tomorrow When the War Began, you don't know who the army is. They appear to be Asian in appearance, but it never identifies which country they're from. So it kind of sparks a lot of debate, that story. But yeah, for our American viewers and watchers, it's definitely worth checking out if you've enjoyed Red Dawn. Yeah, so Tomorrow When the War Began was quite similar to Red Dawn, I found. So that's another one to check out. And just in wrapping up the Red Dawn conversation, Bob, do you have a favorite scene from the film, or the one that sticks out in your memory?
I mean, Wolverine, when he screamed, when they're doing the Wolverine thing and they're yelling out Wolverines. I mean, I remember us doing that in high school, just as kind of a group thing, as a goof. Like we would go camping and then somebody would invariably, and obviously it's the 80s, we're camping, so we're probably drinking and all of that. And so, you know, somebody would invariably just yell out, you know, Wolverines or whatever. So, you know, that would be that. And just the transformation of C. Thomas Howell to where he kind of goes from, you know, that straight-laced kid, that little kid, and then, you know, Powers Booth is like, you know, all of that killing's going to eat you up inside. And, you know, he just, you know, they almost, if they had really wanted to delve deeper into that piece of it, they kind of could have made it a bit more of an art film if they'd have kind of dug into the collapse of his psyche or character or whatever. But obviously, it wasn't meant to do that. It was meant to be what it was, which was just a very loud, noisy film. And you know, sometimes
Absolutely.
there's nothing wrong with that, you know?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely. It was a lot of action, and you know, and it does show a considerable change in the characters who start off as these innocent high school kids who become hunters, who become soldiers, and in some case, some of them become murderers, right? Or mercenaries. And then in the end, they're I guess they're heroes. But like you said, they don't necessarily win. And we don't really know what happens after this town gets taken over. So yeah, interesting movie, and I enjoyed it. So, you know, thank you for bringing it to the podcast, and hopefully some people here who haven't seen it will go and check out Red Dawn. All
Awesome.
right. So we might move on to your next film, if that's okay, Bob. And this is the film for you that you told me was really profound. It changed your life, changed your perspective in some way. And you know, I really like this category out of the three, I think, because everyone always has a very personal choice, and it's always an interesting choice and an interesting movie. So yeah, please share with us, what is this film that changed your life?
The movie is called Papillon, which came out in the late 70s. It starred Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman.
The dreams of freedom. The dangers of escape. Steve McQueen. Dustin Hoffman, Papillon, the greatest adventure of escape ever filmed.
It's based on the life of Henri Charette, which I may have mispronounced that, but he was a French gentleman that escaped from French Guiana, or also known as Devil's Island, and made several escape attempts and finally got away, then eventually wrote his autobiography. I found the book. My mother owned the book, so I borrowed it. I was a very voracious reader, so I read it. And then, of course, when the movie came out on, again, in the 80s, when it finally popped up on your Cinemaxes and HBO, even though it was an R-rated film, my mother let me watch it because, again, I had already read the book and knew what is about what it was about. It's not considered one of Steve McQueen's biggest films, even though it was a successful movie when it came out. Again, I think it's a combination of it's essentially Papillon is my all-time favorite book, so it strikes right there as one of my all-time favorite movies. What I like about it, really what it does it for me, is it's the perseverance aspect. It's the never give up, the keep moving forward, the okay, you captured again. It's the fact that you can be, you know, essentially on your knees and being beat down to the bottom of everything, but yet you still fight through it and survive and ultimately escape and get away. Now, postscript to that is, as the years have gone by and we have more information and have more knowledge, they have done some investigating into Henri Charette's life, and they have been able to prove that there was nobody of that name at Devil's Island. They can't prove the story is fake, but they've kind of started to assume that he took that story from several people and combined it together with pieces of his own. I don't know. You know how that goes. When once we all got modern technology and the Google and all of that, they could go back and start tracking records. And let's be honest, those records weren't exactly complete, even when Devil's Island was open and existed. So regardless of all of that, it's still my all-time favorite book. It meant a lot to me as a young person, and I still read it once or twice a year. I've got a paperback and I've got a hardback that I keep put away And again, I break it out every year regardless, and I read it, and then I invariably go back and watch the movie. I've got an original cover of the movie poster. I've got an original movie poster framed it on my wall.
Oh, wow.
As a matter of fact.
Fantastic.
I should have brought in here, and I kind of forgot, so I didn't bring it, so I don't have it in front
of
me.
Okay. I'll get you to send me a picture of it, and we can have it pop up.
I can do that. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
But that, to me, I think it's a great film to watch. It's a classic piece of 70s cinema. Steve McQueen's excellent in it. Dustin Hoffman is excellent in
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yep.
To me, it's just a great film all the way around.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So I might come back to the cast for a minute, if that's okay, and we'll talk about some of those other things. So Steve McQueen was a big star in like the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Sadly passed away far too early, way before his time, but made some great films. And, you know, he was no stranger to, I guess, the films about war and about survival, you know, with The Great Escape, which is another classic mm-hmm. movie. And yeah, his performance in this has to be one of his best ever. Would you agree?
I think so. I think even the movie gets lauded as it's considered, it's not considered to be a great film, but it's a great Steve McQueen performance. And again, it's considered to be a great Dustin Hoffman performance. And again, that's early Dustin Hoffman too.
Very early.
So, it doesn't necessarily measure up to one of his bigger films. And a lot of people don't even know about the movie. I mean, they did a remake a few years ago, but if you ask somebody to name a great Steve McQueen film, Papillon doesn't come up on the list.
No, I hadn't heard of it either, to be honest. So it's another film you've introduced me to. Thank you. I mentioned to my dad, you know, who is a big Steve McQueen fan, that, you know, this episode was coming up and he'd seen Papillon, and he's seen every Steve McQueen film. So he might be watching this episode now. So hi, Dad. hope we're doing Steve McQueen justice. But yeah, and Dustin Hoffman, obviously, like you said, early Dustin Hoffman, he really took off in the 70s. You know, we've had one of his other films featured on the podcast, All the President's Men, all the way back in the early days of the show. And yeah, it's interesting how those two characters, what brings them together, and then eventually, of course, they're separated because Steve McQueen is put into, you know, solitary confinement for months and months. But then Dustin Hoffman's character decides he's just going to make the most of life in prison, and kind of takes on the pride of having this job and having a responsibility. And I found it really interesting when they eventually were brought back together, and Steve McQueen's character's like, right, it's time to try and escape again. You know, I need your help. You know, you're the brains. You can help us survive on the outside. I'll help us get out of here. And then Dustin Hoffman's character's like, well, you know, I've got a purpose now. I've got a job, you know. So it says a lot about, you know, the difference between those two men about survival and wanting to escape and seeing prison as hell versus Dustin Hoffman's character, who almost becomes like institutionalized. And he's like, well, I'm stuck here. I might as well just kind of make the most of it. Yeah. So I found that to be a really interesting relationship between the two. So do you have any sort of thoughts on that? Like, what was going on there?
I mean, there's definitely, they go from two people that, quite honestly, the only reason Steve McQueen's, you know, Papillon's being nice to him is because of who he is and the money that he can possibly get from him, which is why he's helping him in the first place. So they go to have a real bond of love and affection. And at the end of the day, Steve McQueen, or the Papillon character, was a rough, tough character to start with. He certainly was not a Boy Scout in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. And Dustin's character, Louis Daga, is a prim and proper city guy. So he's not really cut out for that sort of environment, that life in the first place. So you could see why he would become institutionalized, because he always kind of, I mean, other than breaking the rules, which is what got him in trouble in the first place, he's not a tough guy, not a manly man in any way, shape, or form, and is not going to, you know, fight his way out of a wet paper bag ultimately. So he needs that person there to kind of guide him in that respect, into where, you know, Louis's got the brains to put deals together and make things happen, at least early on in the movie. Yep. But you can see that there's a genuine, at the end, there's a genuine love and affection for each other. And he knows when Papillon leaves, that's it. There's no coming back from that. When he jumps off that rock into the water, we're done. That's it. He's not coming back.
He was just so determined to be free. Like, freedom to him was everything, you know, and that drive to survive and not be confined was, you know, was incredible. And that's what really grabbed me, was, it spends more time with Papillon, Steve McQueen's character, than Dustin Hoffman's character. And just watching, especially when he's in solitary confinement for like, 6 months or whatever it is, he's on half rations, he's in 23 hours of darkness a day, and you just sort of see him deteriorate, and it looks like he's about to give in and tell the guards who's been giving him, notes and stuff, but he doesn't. He's like, no, I'm gonna keep fighting even if it kills me. So it was amazing. Like his will to survive was just unbelievable.
And even better, when he recovers and you see him pick up the bug and he goes to eat it and then he stops and lets the bug go. So you get this, to me, that more than anything shows where he's turned back almost into a human again, and he's regained his quote unquote sanity, because 6 months before he'd have ate that bug in a heartbeat because he had to survive. So that to me was fascinating, when he picks it up and he kind of goes like that, and then he realizes what he's doing, puts him in the window, and then lets him go. I'm done. I mean, that's just, it's a great scene. And even
Absolutely.
with the worms, like he so wants to get away that he takes a cigar from the leper and puts it in his mouth, having no idea what he's ultimately done.
That's right.
Is he giving himself leprosy? He doesn't know. He just wants to escape and get away so badly. Like, my attitude was always like, dude, you're on an island with, I hate to say this, but I'm a dude. You got two wives. You're running the show. You can come and go as you please on the island. Why in the heck are you going to leave the island? The chief loves you. You're the king of the land. And even that's not good enough, because he wants to get back ultimately to France, which he never quite really gets there, until years later. But it's like he had, I guess in my eyes, as a essentially a 13 or 14-year-old boy, when I watched the film, it's like, dude, you're on an island paradise. Why are you leaving?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was that was an interesting part of the film. It's like, oh, okay, well, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe he should just stick around. But no, he's like, nope, I'm determined. And even towards the end, where him and Dustin Hoffman end up on Devil's Island, is it? Where they're kind of isolated and just living on their own. And you can see Dustin Hoffman's character, his sanity has completely slipped, and he's living this little cocoon and everything. And he contemplates escaping, but he stays behind and just watches Papillon dive into the water and float away to freedom, supposedly. So, and just quickly, Bob, could you tell us a little bit about, I guess, that time in history, like where this is set, what was going on? Was this around World War I, World War II? I wasn't quite sure on the
This
history.
is essentially, I believe, it's right after World War I. So it's in between World War I and World War II, which is essentially French Guiana is where they actually had the colony, the Devil's Island colony. And of course, it's twofold. So you have like the solitary area, and then of course you had the actual colony, which you see at the end, where they're sitting there and they have individual huts, and because they're never coming back to France in any way, shape, or form. And ultimately, from what I understand, they shut it down because, quite honestly, French was fighting in World War II. They obviously Hitler had, essentially had taken over France at that point. So there was no money to worry about an offshoot colony, out and about in the middle of the wilderness. So they basically it didn't survive. And everybody that was there eventually either lived the rest of their life out there, or they, brought them back home, or put them in another, God only knows what happened to them. The it still exists to this day. You can actually do tours there now. I mean, at this point, it's basically almost completely, down to rubble now. I mean, you can't even really see the cells anymore because it's been sitting for so long. Which, if you were to go there, yes, you could actually go and view the facilities and all of that type of thing. Yeah, it was a, again, different time period too, where you could do that type of things. And technically, Papillon was convicted of killing a pimp, which he swore up and down he didn't do, and that's really all he did. But ultimately, I think the other portion of that is when they talk about them in the movie, when he's guilty of living a wasted life, and he's like, I'm guilty of that, because he was a petty criminal. He wasn't doing anything constructive. And I think that resonated with me, maybe even more so as I've gotten older, is that, whether we like it or not, life is short and you don't want to waste it. And there's a lot of people, myself included, that certainly spent part of their time, especially in my early 20s, to where you're just partying and working to make just enough money to party, and you're living at home, and you're ultimately being kind of a bum and a loser and not really getting anything done. You know, and I think most of us, to some extent, kind of go through that time period to where we are living a wasted life. And if I had died at 22, nobody would have anything to say other than, okay, well, he was a good son to his mother and father, but he certainly hadn't accomplished anything, or was even in the, you know, bagging groceries at Food Lion, getting hammered, you know, four times a week. So I certainly wasn't doing anything constructive at that time period. So that's one of the things that always stood out for me, is that aspect where he admits he did. He lived a way not doing anything good at all.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it was he had to escape. So he saw that as like maybe his second chance to live a life and redeem himself. It's like, I'm not gonna die in prison for this crime I committed and for this past life and all these atrocities. I'm gonna earn my freedom and go and live a life, you know. And I guess that's what he did. And he eventually wrote the book and shared his story. So he I guess in a lot of ways found that kind of freedom and redeemed himself. So yeah, it's a great story of survival. And again, another new film for me that I've watched, and we've added this to our repertoire of films now on My Movie Story. The first Steve McQueen film we've featured on the podcast, so hopefully there'll be some more along the
Nice.
way. So yeah, thanks for bringing it.
No, no script to that. According to Steve McQueen, Henry Sheree was a complete a-hole and was on set, was very demanding, and apparently was just, unfortunately, was not a very nice guy. So regardless of what I may have romanticized in my head, because I was a child when I read the book and I thought it was the coolest thing, as we get older, unfortunately, the reality hits us that, you know, he was, unfortunately, was not a nice person, and all of the success of the book kind of went to his head, and he lived his life and did his thing. He certainly, unfortunately, not remembered as being somebody who was a humble man in any way, shape, or form.
There you
The
go.
thing is, I actually have the butterfly on my shoulder,
Oh, the
which I
tattoo.
don't see
Oh,
that.
well.
So the
There
butterfly
you
that he's
go.
got on his chest, I don't really have a chest, so I didn't put it on my chest. I had it done on my shoulder. But
Well,
it's the same style of butterfly, the Papillon butterfly with the darker colors.
that's
And I
cool.
had that put on. That's my homage. That's how much I love that book and that movie, is the butterfly I put on my shoulder.
There you go. That's a true fan there. Sign of a true fan. I guess I wouldn't be able to do a tattoo of my favorite movie, because my favorite movie is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. So I don't know how that would go down as a tattoo.
Yeah,
You know, the silhouette of the
that's not
killer in
gonna
the shower
fly.
with the knife or something.
You
All
could
right,
do like a big
awesome.
old back tattoo. That would be a little creepy.
It would, yeah. I don't think I'd get away with that, but fantastic. All right, well, thanks, Bob, again for bringing this movie to the podcast. And we've got one more film to talk about, and we've been saving this one to last because I know it's one you want to talk about quite extensively. There's a special connection to this film for you from when you were younger. And people might be surprised at what film this is. You know, they'll know the original very well. It's a famous musical from the 70s that most people like and launched the career of a well-known actor. But we're going to be talking about its lesser known, lesser viewed sequel. So tell us, what is this movie that is your all-time favorite?
It is a camp classic. It is a terrible movie. It sold like five copies, and it is Grease 2.
What are you gonna be when you grow up?
A burden on society.
Grease 2, the feeling goes on forever.
Daggone near ended multiple careers when it came out. The movie came out in 82. It came and went from the box office very quickly. It was just, I mean, all of the critics bludgeoned it. Everybody bludgeoned it. The lead actor, Maxwell Caulfield, made it a point to say that it basically ended his career in Hollywood for a good 10 years. He couldn't
Gosh.
get an acting role. Now, obviously, Michelle Pfeiffer succeeded because she's M Michelle Pfeiffer. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's fascinating about that movie is you've got to remember 1983, HBO, Cinemax, all of those, there's not a ton of movies, so they're showing the same movies over and over again. So I watched Grease 2 probably 1,000 times when it was on, and then we ended up making a VHS copy of it.
Right.
So that movie, so it be there's an intro to the movie when they're going to school, and it's literally the Temptations singing, "You got to go back to school."
Right.
Every single year, it became a family tradition. Before myself, my brother, and my sister started school, we would sit down on that Sunday before school started. We would make popcorn, and we would watch that film, and my mother would watch that film with us.
Nice.
So even after my brother graduated, it got to the point when I was a senior. My friends knew I did it every year, and they would come over and watch the movie with us. Didn't
Yep.
necessarily like it, but it was an event in the house. And when my sister's 3 years younger than I am, she watched it and then would do the same thing. So up until Casey graduated, that was an every single beginning of school staple. My mother would sing along to the movie, especially the beginning part. She would look at us and be like, "You got to go back to school. Thank God the kids are going back to school. I can get them out of my hair," and
Yeah.
that type of thing.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that is a treasured family memory of my mother. My mother passed away in 09, so it's one of my fondest memories. My sister loves the movie as much as I do. And we can recite the soundtrack and the songs. As a matter of fact, when we get around each other, her husband, it drives him up the wall because we will literally go back and forth with comments on the movie and we'll talk in soundtrack to each other.
Yep.
And it's ridiculous. I know it's a garbage film. It's considered, at one point, it was considered to be like one of the worst films ever made.
Yeah.
I watched a little mini documentary on it and they talked about they knew they were running out of time to produce a sequel. They were actually going to do a third one at one point, but the movie did so poorly they killed it. Everybody forgets that the one of the characters in the film, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, the guy that played Shooter McGavin in Happy
Oh,
Gilmore
yeah.
is actually in that movie
Yeah, I noticed, yeah.
as one of the T-Birds. Obviously, Adrian Zemed was the head T-Bird guy, and he was on that William Shatner TV show in the 80s. I can't remember the name of the show. So he kind of had a career, but for me,
TJ something.
J. Hooker, there you go. Yeah,
TJ
with Bill
Hooker,
Shatner.
yeah, the cop show, yeah.
To me, it just I can't not watch that movie. I watch it at least probably once every couple of months. I've got the CD still for the soundtrack.
Oh
It's on my
wow.
computer. I'm over the top proud of it, and I don't care. I know it's a terrible film,
Yeah.
but it's a
That's
treasured
it.
childhood memory for me,
Yeah, that's
and
it.
something that bonds me and my sister. My brother never
Yeah.
got into the movie, and doesn't really enjoy it. There's probably only one or two people that I personally know that actually like that film, that will admit that they like that film.
Yeah,
But
absolutely.
I absolutely love it. And again, it's a treasured memory of my mother, and it always brings me a little peace, a little solitude when I miss
Yeah.
her, when I think, hell, I'm getting wound up even thinking about it right now, because I was blessed to be very close with my mother. I'm very close to my father, so I'm blessed in that department. And I know that, and it is truly, it's a treasured memory for me. It just
Yeah.
is.
Absolutely. I can picture what you were talking about there, like, back when we were young, and I'm a kid of the 90s, but even then, like, we still had family movie nights, like Sunday night in Australia, like before we got cable and streaming and DVDs and all that stuff. A Sunday night that would pr be the premiere of a movie that was in the cinemas maybe 2 or 3 years before that. And it would be advertised on TV all week. And we only had the one TV in the house. We don't have all the devices that we can watch our TV shows on now. It was one TV. Me and my sisters would sit on the floor, like on a blanket, and have food, and mum and dad on the couch, and we'd all watch a movie together. And that's something that's kind of been lost now, I think. It's great that we've got all these devices, and you can start watching a show on your phone, at work on your lunch break, and when you come home, you can watch it on TV or your tablet or your laptop, you know, and all these things. But yeah, like it's definitely something that's been lost, which is a real shame. And just on the note of being a film that's so bad it's good, like I think we're all entitled to have a couple of those movies. You know, for me, it's a movie from a kid's movie from the 80s. You might remember the Garbage Pail Kids movie. Did you you remember that?
Yeah, that's another movie that
Terrible.
came
Absolutely
very
terrible.
popular.
One of the worst films, if not the worst film ever
Oh,
made.
yeah.
There's so much wrong with that film. You know, but I love it, you know, and I've done a special review of the movies of my childhood on my blog, and I talk about the Garbage Pail Kids, and it's a disgusting, vile, offensive, sexist, misogynist, everything wrong with that movie, but I love it, you know. And every few years or so, I'll watch it and I'll just be like, oh my God, this is terrible. But it reminds me of my childhood. It reminds me about being a kid, and like that was the stuff we watched and talked about. We had the Garbage Pail Kids cards that we would trade and stuff, and yeah, I just loved it. Yeah.
I remember those well. I mean, and that, yeah, that movie is not a good movie. And you,
No.
it qualifies underneath movies you can't make anymore.
Oh
You know,
yes.
you,
Yes.
there's a, and there, especially in the 80s, there's a ton of those now that you go back and you go, really, was that even, like, even the guys that wrote the movies are like, I apologize for this scene. And we didn't really think this one through. And we would never, you can't make those type of movies anymore. And there's, and let's be honest, it's kind of a good reason for some of those movies that are, you're just like, that's just not a good idea. So if you watch it through a modern lens, you're just like, ooh, that's icky, you
That's
know?
right. Yeah.
Kind
In
of have to take
today's
it with a
ultra
grain of
sensitive
salt.
world, it would be cancelled even before it got made, I reckon.
Yeah, you kind of have
Absolutely.
to take it with a grain of salt, you know,
For
right,
sure.
wrong, or otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, and just coming back to Greece too, some of the songs in this movie I found were quite interesting. The original Greece, like the songs all were about, you know, love and friendship and having a good time, and it had a very positive angle to it. This was set in the kind of the same era. We imagine it's the year after the original Greece, because it's a new group of seniors, and it's got one of the pink ladies returns and who's still in high school, the same teachers and all of that. So I don't imagine much time has passed, but it's made and filmed in the 80s, and it's a bit more dirty, it's a bit more raw. Like one of the songs is called Reproduction, and they're in
Yeah.
class and they're talking about, you know, sex and childbirth, and they're all like making out and getting it on with each other almost. And then the one at the
Let's do
bowling
it for
alley.
our country.
Yeah, that's
Remember
right.
that one? Let's do it for
Yeah.
our country. You got to remember that movie came out. I'm 10, 11 when I watched it. So a lot of that went right over my head. It
Sure.
wasn't until a few years later, it was like, oh, I get it now. I see what they're saying. It really, but yeah, you're absolutely right. That there's so much innuendo in that movie, it's not even funny.
It's
I
on,
mean,
there's a
it's,
lot. There's a lot,
yeah.
yeah. Yeah, you know, despite all that, like I thought, you know, it's terrible, but it's kind of got its own little charm, you know. And I did a bit of research online, and actually it does have a bit of a fan base, this film, who will watch this over the original one. You know, they might see the original one is a bit too kind of squeaky clean for them. This is just like in your face, unapologetic. Yeah, so it's definitely interesting. It's something that's probably been, you know, kind of lost and forgotten a little bit, but due to the internet now, like I was able to go online and find a whole bunch of clips about it and research it and stuff. So that was interesting.
Yeah, because ain't nobody paying to see that movie.
No.
I mean, let's be honest. Nobody's paying to see that movie. And it's kind of an early version of what I would say, what you would call a cash grab. Like, you know how a movie does really well and then they make the second one because they figure, like Blair Witch 2 would be a good example of that, to where the first
Yes.
Blair Witch popped up. So they immediately green light a second one. You know it's going to be atrocious and
Oh
not do
yeah.
well, but you're going to get that initial. You're gonna make your money back on the front end, and that's really all you care about. It's like watching the straight to DVD movies that they used to make, to where they're just rehashing the same footage, and the next thing you know, you've got Carnosaur 2, Carnosaur 3, Carnosaur 4, and
That's
they're
it.
just piecing stuff together from the old movie and
Yeah.
throwing it on late night HBO and figuring somebody will watch it, will at least make our money back. I
Yeah,
mean, it's
fa
an early
fast money, right? Yeah. It's about kind of striking while the iron's hot and trying to capture some of the audience and the enthusiasm from the first film. And yeah, and history shows that any film that's ever rushed and made for that purpose is usually terrible. And you can see it on the screen. You can see the continuity issues. You can see like, oh, that scene only had one take, obviously. Like, at one point you can even see actors looking at the camera or so it's like, yeah, it's definitely a cash grab. But yeah, and just going back to what you were talking about at the start, how this was a tradition for you to watch it before you went back to school, eating popcorn, spending that time with your mother. Really beautiful, really tender sort of thing. You mentioned that you continue to watch this film now, and do you have any other sort of movie watching traditions you do now with your family? Anything along those lines?
Not so much with my family. I mean, obviously, my ex-wife and I, we had got custody of her younger half brothers when the boys were 14. So I introduced them to a ton of kind of the 80s films that were acceptable. Funny enough, we were, how movies don't get, you can't make certain movies. My buddy and I introduced his, the kids were probably 14 at the time, 14 or 15. We introduced him to the original Bad News Bears. And everybody thinks there's that one scene where the little blonde kid who's like 7 basically insults every ethnic and racial group inside of like 8 seconds. And everybody, and I had forgotten that was in there. So he's literally sitting there and he's like, that we got a this and a that and this and a booger eating this and a moron and all of these words that we're not allowed to use anymore. And for good reason. And I looked over at my buddy and he was like both of us had totally forgot that was in there. We just, it didn't, when we were children, maybe it didn't register, we didn't understand the validity, what it meant now. And even his kids looked at us like, you're not supposed to, that's not supposed, they're not supposed to say that. And
It
it's
was a
a
different
perfect
time back then,
example
wasn't it? It was a
of
different time.
different time period where you, even when they remade it, they still, you can't do any stuff like that. And you almost would have to, you got to cut that entire chunk out because they're using words that you would never hear anymore. So I think for me, I still watch, there's probably about 4 or 5 cheesy movies that HBO and Cinemax, that's all they had the rights to. So they would reshow some of the worst films of the 80s. And I'll give you an example. Six Pack, the movie that Kenny Rogers made, sold like 8. It's a NASCAR. He raises these. He ends up with these 6 orphans, and this is like Kenny Rogers, like his one big movie thing that he did. Movie didn't sell. It's a classic. I've watched it a ton. My sister's watched it a ton. There's a movie that was actually filmed in Australia called The Pirate Movie. Remember, you and I spoke briefly about that with Christy McNichol and the guy that was in the Blue Lagoon, Christopher Atkins,
Yes, you
which is.
mentioned, yeah.
It's a terrible sings, it's a terrible movie, but it's another one of those movies that about once or twice a year, it reminds me of my childhood, and it's another bad movie that I can sit back and watch that quite honestly has never been released on streaming because nobody ever wanted to release it on streaming because there's no money in it. So you can go to YouTube and watch it for free because who's going to pay to see that?
There's no chance it's going to make any money now. It's like,
No. So for me personally, it's kind of a when I feel nostalgic, that's the type of stuff that I will watch. And then again, when I see my sister, we almost immediately go into Grease 2 mode without what we just can't help ourselves. We can, we'll, dump the face, keep the nose, we'll make a little, we can make comments, playing different characters. We can. I can sing every lyric and do the entire album on karaoke. Moment's notice. You could put a gun to my head and I could sing those stupid songs. I'm just, it's what it is.
It is, yeah, that's it.
It means that much to me with as a connection to my mother, as to my family, as almost anything in this entire world. It just does.
That's it. That's it. And that's beautiful. And really, you've captured the whole kind of theme of what this podcast is about, or what I like it to be about is, your films are your films. It's not about trying to convince anybody it's good or tell people they have to go and see it. It's just your film, your connection, your story, and maybe that'll get some people curious and be like, I'll go and watch that and put myself in Bob's shoes or see it from his point of view. And maybe I can get into this. Maybe I can find something about this film I can appreciate or understand. And You know, and that's the beauty of this podcast and the films that you and our other guests choose, is that, you know, we're not biased and we just discuss the films and the stories behind them. So, yeah, thank you. And you know, these were three films I hadn't seen before up until now. So I've added them to my list now of films that I've seen, and I've seen a lot. Still got a lot more films to see. I haven't seen everything, but no, thank you. Thank you, Bob. And just in wrapping up, any other honorable mentions? Were there any other films that you thought about talking about tonight or that you'd love to talk about?
Honorable mentions, I would say that, you know, again, being a child of the 80s, any of your classic big budget 80 movies would have fit right in the Red Dawn category. I mean, they recently had the remake of Roadhouse, which again is another loud
Yep.
80s movie.
That's right.
As far as, you know, something that is a personal favorite that I can watch over and over again, obviously Grease 2 heads the list. But again, some of those crappier 80s movies that I watched 1,000 times that nobody else likes but me, I can sit down and watch.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm a fan of all the original Star Wars because I was a Star Wars kid, Indiana Jones, that type of stuff. I would say in terms of life-changing movie, there's a few. Probably Pursuit of Happiness would have been one.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's a good one.
And only because I actually got to meet Chris Gardner at
Oh,
a
wow.
real estate convention years ago, and he kind of gave us the backstory on what really went on and what really happened. And just a really genuine person all the way around. But yeah, that's when I feel nostalgic and want to kind of feel that close to home, then yeah, I'm going to put in, quite honestly, I'm probably going to put in some terrible 80s movie. I'm not an art house guy. I'm not going to pretend to be an art house guy. I love 12 Angry Men and some really great films, but I also own just about every 80s crap movie or big budget explosion movie that came down the pike. I've got your Rambos and your diehards and all of that. And I, at the end of the day, I embrace it and I am who I am. I'm a child of the 80s completely, without a
Absolutely.
doubt.
And you know what a decade it was, and a decade like no other, and so unique in terms of its movies and all of that. So yeah, and I love
I feel
revisiting
like
the
I hit it
films that
right
I
on my
grew
head
up
because
on.
you figure I graduated 1990, so I caught like all of it. You know, I didn't catch a piece of it or the first part or the back. I literally got to go through the whole cycle of it. And you know, it seems silly now at 52, but you know, as a member of the Generation X, the last of the no internet, you know, community, it's a fascinating thing. And
For sure, for sure. Well, I was born in 82. I only really kind of remember the last few years of the 80s, so I'm kind of more of a kid of the 90s and a teen of the 90s, which was an interesting time to be a teenager, especially in the late 90s. But the 80s is where it's at, you know, and it's such a nostalgic time now, and we all wish we could just go back and live there. And show why shows like Stranger Things are such a hit, because it's, you know, it captures that innocence and all the, you know, riding around on the bikes and playing out until it was dark, and then not knowing where your friends were, you had to go and find them, and no mobile phones. It was great. It was fantastic. So we've featured quite a few 80s movies on the podcast, and you know, for that reason, you know, it's a journey back to better times in a lot of ways.
It's a night and day time period. It's a really, it
100%.
really is. I mean, I know some people will say it's, you know, they'll play it like it's the greatest time ever and the world's collapsing. But you know, every generation says that about the next
Of
generation,
course,
that everybody's doing it wrong. I mean, you know, comic books were the devil in the 40s and 50s, and you know, there's always something that's going to get blamed for something else,
Of
and
course,
that's just kind of how it goes. And it is
that's it.
what you know,
That's
you
it.
got to take it with a grain of salt. And we're just way more aware of stuff that maybe we didn't either A, want to talk about, or B, just didn't see because we didn't have the knowledge for it at the time. All we had was the freaking newspaper and the Encyclopedia Britannica, and that was the extent of your knowledge.
That's
You
it.
know,
Yeah, that's
where
it.
now I can Google anything on my phone.
That's right. That's right. Like it's all there, yeah, which has got a lot of pros and cons to it at the same time. But yeah, well, thank you again, Bob, for coming onto My Movie Story, sharing your movies with us and your connection to them. Really nice to hear the story, of the tradition behind Grease 2 and watching that, a really a beautiful thing, which has, sadly is not done enough these days. Hopefully our generation might bring it back a little bit more. But yeah, thank you again for being a guest on the show. It's been great having you here.
Thanks a lot. I had a blast and I appreciate it.
Cheers. All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into My Movie Story. We hope you enjoyed today's episode with our special guest and the movies that we talked about. Don't forget to hit that like button, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast platform. Your support means a lot to us. You can also stay connected with us on social media for all the latest updates and special content, and you'll find our page on Facebook. Until next time, take care and enjoy the movies. See you on the next episode.